Okay, now the big Saturday panel. As I said earlier, one of the most important topics we could be talking about, energy policy, energy development. And the West plays prominently in this this topic. The West has been known as the frontier region for since it was identified as a U.S. region, and now we're an energy frontier. We have a state, Wyoming, that's number one in coal production, passed up West Virginia many 11, 12 years ago. And Wyoming coal fuels power plants in the Midwest and South, that far away. Wyoming also, I discovered recently, is number one in total BTUs, having passed up Oklahoma and Texas when you add up oil and gas production as well. So Wyoming's number one in BTUs. Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Montana, and California are also important for coal, oil, and gas production. That's that set of fossil fuel energy. Meanwhile, the West is also number one in potential clean energy, especially when you include the Western Great Plains for wind production. The West is number one for wind potential, number one for solar in the Southwest, number one for potential geothermal power, and number one for potential wave action power, because the way the ocean currents work, the Pacific Ocean is where that's probably going to happen, if it happens. Clean energy, of course, is a debatable concept. When you talk about large-scale industrial development of wind fields and solar fields marching across landscapes and tapping geothermal resources that might disrupt water supplies and wave energy that might disrupt marine ecosystems. And you talk about building new energy grid to service all that energy development. It's a topic on which the environmental movement itself is split. You have some environmentalists saying we have to build new grid and develop clean energy on an industrial scale in the West in order to address climate change in a realistic fashion. And you have other environmentalists who are battling that that idea because of impacts on local ecosystems in the West. And there's another kind of battle taking shape now. Should that energy development take place on public lands in the West, the federal lands that that define the West, or on private land? And so this is a great place to be talking about those issues. The moderator of our panel today, John Daly, you can pick him out up there because he's the handsomest young guy up there, sort of. He's a TV guy. He's from KSL TV in Salt Lake City, which is the NBC affiliate, number one in the market. He covers a variety of topics, including transportation, politics, the environment, and investigative projects. He's a skier, a mountain hiker, and he plays soccer. He did a night journalism fellowship at Stanford in 2007-08, and he attended his first SEJ conference 13 or 14 years ago. Our other panelists, going from John on this end, Nancy Sutley, chair of the White House Council on Environmental Quality, arguably the most important environmental issues official in the Obama administration. She has some roots in the West, in California politics and environmental agencies, was deputy mayor of L.A., and I think she's an interesting sign of the rising political influence of the West in terms of on a national scale, taking federal positions. Next to Nancy is is Karen Harbert, director of the Institute for 21st Century Energy, U.S. Chamber of Commerce. I haven't met Karen before today, but chatting with her over lunch, I discovered the Chamber of Commerce's headquarters. Of course, they're a strong voice for business in this country, their definition of business interests. Their headquarters is across from the White House, and she says their building is larger than the White House, so I think that's an interesting comparison. She also has some roots in the West, or some touches down in the West. She vacations in Montana and Colorado. Next to her is Karan Suckling, the leader of arguably the hardest-hitting environmental group on a national scale now, the Center for Biological Diversity, which is based in Tucson and started out as a small southwestern environmental group and has seen tremendous growth over the last 5 years. So now it has offices across the country, and a much larger staff, and you can find Karan appearing on national television talking about national environmental issues, including the Gulf oil spill. And last on that side is Randy Udall, who's an environmental issues consultant based in Carbondale, Colorado, in the Aspen area. Randy is part of the Udall clan that is well known to many in this room. His father, Mo Udall, longtime congressman from Tucson. His brother, Mark, is a Colorado senator. His cousin, Tom, is a New Mexico senator. And the family includes Stuart Udall, the former Secretary of Interior, who helped preserve a million acres in Alaska or more during the Carter administration. Randy's a great thinker. He thinks of the big picture. He also knows a lot of details. He's frank, and he's green, but also realistic. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to John and the rest of the panel. Thanks.
All right. Thanks very much, Ray. Appreciate it. Here's the plan, everybody. We're going to try to make this as lively and conversational as possible. We're going to hear from each of the panelists. I'll have some questions for them, and then we'd like to open it up for you to ask your questions. So we'll try to get to that as quickly as possible. We're going to start with Nancy. Nancy, give us the administration's take on energy and where we're going.
Well, thanks a lot, John, and thanks for the invitation to be here. I was came last year, and it was a great opportunity to hear from all of you and to talk a little bit about what we're doing as an administration. Energy is a real priority for the Obama administration, and we are trying as an administration, sort of across the administration, of trying to find ways to help steer our nation, our economy, towards a sustainable and job-producing clean energy economy, and working with the private sector and with partners in state and local government and with non-governmental organizations. And I think in the almost we're now coming close to 2 years, I think we've accomplished a lot, and obviously have a lot more to do. One of the most important things that we did early on was in the Recovery Act to put about $90 billion into clean energy to create jobs and to make real strides forward in American clean energy technology. And so if you look at things like renewable energy manufacturing, investments in smart grid, investments in advanced battery manufacturing, things that are important to drive the clean energy economy forward, but also create tremendous opportunity for American investment in technology and creating jobs all across the country. Looking at addressing the most important challenges associated with clean energy and with climate change and with air pollution, in putting DOT, the Department of Transportation, and EPA together to put into place tough new fuel economy standards and proposing the first greenhouse gas emission standards for cars and light-duty trucks that'll save us about almost 2 billion barrels of oil. Now working on the next generation of fuel economy standards for light-duty vehicles and the first fuel economy standards for heavy-duty trucks. Also looking at this as a global phenomenon and a global issue, spearheading a number of different initiatives at the international level, including commitments by the largest nations in the world to eliminate fossil fuel subsidies, working on a bilateral basis with a number of countries to help to encourage the growth of the clean energy economy, working in through multilateral organizations, and hosting the first ever clean energy ministerial meeting in July. We're also looking at the federal government's own operations and how we can both lead by example and help to grow the clean energy sector by cutting our energy use and encouraging the use of cleaner sources of energy in the federal government. And, the federal government, it turns out, is the largest single energy consumer in the American economy. We occupy about 500,000 buildings, own about 600,000 vehicles, employ almost 2 million people, I'm forgetting my last little statistic there, but so through executive order, the president has set targets for agencies, including goals for energy efficiency, reducing our greenhouse gas pollution, conserving water, and promoting sustainable communities, and each agency has had to produce a sustainability plan to show how they'd meet those goals, and meaning just one of the goals, which is our greenhouse gas emission reduction goal, a 28% reduction target for the federal government by 2020, that will cut federal energy use by the equivalent of 205 million barrels of oil and avoid between $8 billion and $11 billion in energy costs over the next decade. And in the leading by example category, we announced last week that the most recognizable house in the country, the White House, will get solar panels and solar hot water heating, hopefully by next spring. We believe we have to help to build a clean energy. Thank you. Thank you for the solar energy aficionados out there. We're looking at a lot of ways that we can help to build a clean energy economy, to create American industries and long-lasting jobs, to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and to help to bring down the greenhouse gas pollution that's threatening our planet. And we already see that climate change is affecting communities in the United States and natural places in the United States and all across the world. And the president has made it clear that while we're committed to reducing carbon emissions to avoid the most catastrophic effects of climate change, we also have an obligation to prepare for and respond to the risks and vulnerabilities that we're already beginning to see as a result of climate change and impacts that we may see in the future. So the Council on Environmental Quality, along with the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, put together a climate change adaptation task force, and we released our report on Thursday as a result of a request from the president to develop recommendations about how we can strengthen our nation's capacity to understand and prepare for the risks associated with climate change. And in our report, we recommended that ways that agencies should make planning for adaptation a part of their standard agency planning, thinking about the long-lived infrastructure and the long-term investments we make as a government, ensuring that scientific information about the impacts of climate change is easily accessible to the public and private sector decision makers, and how we're going to get that done. So that's just a couple of the things that we're working on, but I look forward to the discussion. And, I think what I sort of thought I'd like to leave you with is that, you know, in this crowded public policy environment that we live in, it should be clear, and it is clear to us who do this work every day, that the president is committed to confronting these challenges, and maybe some of the most important challenges facing us as a planet, and we believe that our investments and our actions to help to bring the build the clean energy economy will help get us to achieve those goals. So, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much, Nancy Sutley.
Thank you.
Karen Harbert, what's the chamber's vision for our energy future and how we're going to get there?
Well, thanks, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. Let me first, Ray, you made a great offer that all of your members here would buy T-shirts for the Chambers of Commerce. I think that's great. We accept that we would delightfully wear these T-shirts all across America. So we accept. And I'll get them right outside here at the end and hand them out. First of all, I think it's really important that a representative of the business community is here. I'm glad that hopefully you all see it that way too, because I think at the end of the day, you know, Nancy has to manage a very complex process in the government. I used to be in the government. There are 13 federal agencies. And 26 congressional committees that have oversight over energy policy, which is why it is done in a very difficult, it's a very complex policymaking machine at the federal level and then complicate that at the state level with the state bureaucracies. And so it's a very complex maze to generate energy and environmental policy. But at the end of the day, it really is the private sector's ability to operate under the framework and to be able to invest its capital, to utilize its expertise, to generate the innovations that will put more energy options and more environmental options on the table to keep us competitive. Because it is an increasingly competitive world out there, and we have to be able to be the ones to innovate and generate jobs and technologies here at home. And that really falls back on the private sector. And so I think at the end of the day, the private sector sees itself as the solution. I think the debate somehow has evolved into elements of the private sector being the problem. And I don't think that gets us to the solution any faster when we seek to demonize or denigrate parts of the economy that actually are the ones that are going to generate the jobs to get us out of this terrible recession. And then I think we have to be realistic in the way we talk about things going forward. We are in a terrible recession. And we are going to be in a terrible recession for some time. And unemployment is 9.6% right now. We are $13.5 trillion in debt. We're not going to erase that overnight. But the economy is going to come back. I think all of us as Americans want the economy to come back. We want to see the unemployment rate go down. And that's going to require a lot of things to happen. But one of the most important things is that we still have affordable, reliable, and abundant energy. And without that, the industrial pickup won't take place. And so we have to keep in mind the energy is an input to our recovery, but it's also a contributor to our recovery. And by that, I mean the type of jobs that the energy industry itself can generate, all sorts of energy, not just renewable energy and green jobs, but, you know, oil and gas and coal and nuclear all have an appropriate contribution to make to our recovery and to our energy security over time. You know, nuclear has been in the news a lot over the past week, and you know, as we look at solving our environmental challenges and our energy challenges, there's a great intersection in nuclear power. And I think you're seeing a broader swath of the environmental community embrace nuclear energy as a viable solution going forward. It's also a hugely viable economic solution. You know, a nuclear power plant can employ 1,200 people that are good, high-paying jobs in places that there's not a lot of other options. So I think we have to look at energy and environment through a much broader lens. It is part of our economic landscape. It is part of our recovery. And I think we need to see it that way. I think the American public, if you look at all the polling that is being done, most of it being done because we're in a political cycle, the top issue for everybody right now is jobs. But we have to be careful that we don't try and oversell all the types of environmental energy policies that we're looking at just because of jobs. We know that some of the solutions that are out there are going to raise the cost of energy. I think we have to be frank. I think the American public saw a lot of legislation that was passed this past cycle and was a little bit upset that they weren't more involved and understood the transparent costs of some of these things. So going forward, I think we have to recognize our energy and environment reality. We're going to need all sources of energy. We can't pick and choose because that's just not the luxury that we have. And then going forward, I think we have to involve the private sector much more intimately in the process because we have to be able to thrive, innovate, invest, and get our economy back to being healthy again.
All right. Thanks very much, Karen. Kiran, I would assume you have a different perspective on that reality.
I do. I do have a different perspective. And, one of the things about, the idea of demonizing the industry who might innovate, I'm actually more focused on, frankly, demonizing the federal government for failing to regulate, for failing to actually make these industries follow the law. Because for the most part, the industries are doing what industries exist to do, which is to make as much money as possible and spend as little money as possible. And it's the job of the federal government to rein in the kind of abuses that come with that mentality. And it's the federal government that has failed us, I think, here, not so much industry. And unfortunately, the Obama administration is continuing to fail us, as previous administrations have, on energy policy. On March 30th, 20 days before the Deepwater Horizon explosion, the Obama administration announced the largest expansion of offshore oil drilling in 30 years. It wanted to open up much of the Atlantic coast to new offshore oil drilling. It wanted to open up the Eastern Gulf to offshore oil drilling and huge swaths of Alaska. It has not rescinded that proposal in the wake of the BP oil explosion and the whole discussion on the dangers of offshore oil drilling. It's now months late in finalizing that decision. I expect that's because the administration knows that to come out and finalize that now at this moment is going to be extraordinarily embarrassing and damaging to its reputation. But we're going to see that decision coming down the pike. And I think that for the administration to still be in this mode at this time is an indication that it is not really fully committed to the kinds of changes in America's energy infrastructure that are needed. And I think the bottom line here is that despite the White House's very real and I think very sincere concern about global warming, its global warming policies have been ineffectual. Its commitment to actually using the bully pulpit to drive those policies has been ineffectual. And it's currently on track that at the end of the Obama administration, we will be producing more oil from offshore drilling than we did when Obama came into office. The country will be more dependent on offshore oil drilling at the end of his administration than when he came into office. And that is extraordinarily disturbing to the environmental community. The Gulf crisis was the administration's opportunity to galvanize the nation, to build political support from a bully pulpit, and it could only be done from a bully pulpit, to lead America into a necessary, and I think very radical, reinvention of America's energy infrastructure. No other president has had that opportunity. He has seized to take that opportunity. I think he's failed to lead, and he's let the solution to the Gulf crisis devolve down to discussions of new safety procedures, which is not fundamentally what the Gulf crisis was about. I think his lack of investment in real climate change policy was one of the things that led to our inability to pass a climate bill. I think it's one of the things that led to our inability to even pass an energy bill in the wake of the Gulf crisis. And so I think that unless we see some very dramatic changes over the next 2 years, I think history is going to conclude that the president took the most powerful opportunity in American history to move the nation away from fossil fuels and to reinvent our entire energy infrastructure and instead just pissed it down his leg.
All right. Very strong perspective there. Randy, do you agree with that?
I was so worried that we weren't going to have a food fight, and now I'm very, very much reassured that we will. You know, I'm a big fan of recycling, but for Obama to recycle one of Jimmy Carter's 1970s speeches after this Deepwater Horizon thing, I thought was just a tragedy. It was a lost opportunity. So that was a sadness for me personally. Let me just share a few ideas with you about where we are right now in the United States in this strange moment. I think it's important to understand that environmental journalism got its start at a time when global oil production was doubling every decade. The GIs come home from the war in 1945. Global oil production doubles by 1960, doubles again by 1970. We passed the Endangered Species Act, this amazing piece of legislation. We take Noah out of the Bible and we put him into law. And think about that. Honestly, could we even have that discussion today? And I asked my Uncle Stuart about this briefly, just shortly before he died. He said, yeah, Nixon thought we were just protecting the bald eagle. And he started laughing about it because this is a visionary idea. It's a radical idea. It's a fascinating idea. It's an extension of human ethics that just blows my mind even today when I think about it. Same way with wild and scenic rivers and wilderness in Alaska and on and on and on. But we're in a new moment now, and I think the chamber representative really underscored that. Global oil production is not going to double ever again in our lifetime. In fact, it's more likely to go down. Global oil exports are already trending down, a story no one's written. probably the most important energy story in the world. It's clear now that shale gas has been is a real phenomenon, but also an overhyped phenomenon. The Barnett Field in Texas, the granddaddy, is only going to produce as much natural gas as the Jonah Field in southwest Wyoming. So I think we have to wrestle with energy realities in the United States in a way we never have. I've been playing climate change bingo at the back of the room, and every tenth time somebody says climate change, I go bingo quietly to myself. And, you know, for every 200 times we've said climate change here, we've never said depletion. And I think if the chamber fully understood the role that energy played in making us wealthy and fully understood the toll that depletion is taking on global oil supplies, that the chamber would be much more supportive of clean energy initiatives right now, because what's at stake is not the environment, it's prosperity. Prosperity, something even Republicans believe in. Am I out of time yet?
Close.
So I want to caution you. I think your underlying paradigm for thinking about the work you're doing was established in a time of great abundance and great surplus and great wealth. And the nation is not wealthy again. That wealthy anymore. We used to build transcontinental railroads. We can't even build a tunnel under the Hudson now. You know, this was a great nation. This was a nation built on Yankee ingenuity and science and technology and law and private property rights. And we've lost our chops. And clean energy, in my view, is going to be the largest single industry on the planet. Regular energy already is. And clean energy needs to grow in that way. But the chamber's going to spend $50 million this election season to elect people that want to turn the clock back, that want to protect the old polluting industries. And this is sobering to me, so sobering. The Germans last year, who have the solar resource of Juneau, Alaska, installed more photovoltaics in a single year than we have in 50 years. And we invented this stuff.
All right. I wanted to... Thanks, Randy. I wanted to give Nancy an opportunity to respond to what Karan was saying about the Gulf's bill being a missed opportunity. It was an opportunity, in his view, to change the conversation, to set a new course. Was that a missed opportunity?
Well, look, I think that we have been talking about and trying to do things on relating to the building of the clean energy economy since the beginning of the administration. As I said, I mean, the Recovery Act was the first thing, and I think we've done a lot of things. I think, you know, with respect to the oil spill. And I think with all of these energy technologies, I mean, we have to recognize we're in a period of transition, that we're moving towards a cleaner, more sustainable way to power our economy, but it isn't going to happen overnight, and so we're going to continue to depend on resources like oil. Americans' oil consumption goes up, you know, year in and year out. We're going to continue to depend on coal because of its abundance. We're going to continue to rely on other fossil fuels. And while we're building this clean energy economy and transitioning to cleaner sources of energy, that we have to focus on how we can make the development of this balanced energy portfolio cleaner and better for the planet. And, you know, I think with respect to the offshore oil development. And we were at the beginning of our process to try to figure out what makes sense in terms of whether there are new areas that we should be looking at for exploration and drilling. And that, you know, that the announcement in March was just the beginning of a process. I think we've learned a lot from the oil spill. And I do think, you know, whether it's the big solution that everybody wants, the fact is we have to address the safety of the rigs that are operating today and the exploration that is going to continue, even in the areas where, without any changes in the areas that we're exploring for oil, to address those safety things, those are very important. I guess the last thing I'd say is, we have been pushing, and the president has been pushing for the Congress to act on energy and climate legislation, act on legislation in response to the oil spill, and that hasn't happened. And and we continue to need to push Congress to act.
Karen, I wanted to give you an opportunity to respond to Randy. If we're depleting these resources that we know are finite, shouldn't we be heading in a course? And wouldn't the chamber endorse heading in a course that Randy's talking about moving towards sustainable alternatives rather than down the same old path that eventually is going to be a dead end?
No, great, great question. I want to respond to both of them because I think they're interrelated to what they both said. First of all, since we're talking about the facts, let's put the facts on the table about the moratorium, which is 85% of America's resources have been under moratorium for 30 years. They came to a natural expiration. The president lifted his moratorium, and the Congress elected not to put the moratorium back on. All of those areas are not out for lease.
You're talking about moratorium on drilling?
On drilling. Those areas have to be agreed to by the Department of Interior every 5 years with a regular leasing program, and then they decide and they put them out to the private sector to bid on. So all of this didn't just open up and people are going to be sticking straws in all over the world. That's just not accurate. Secondly, depletion. We've been sitting on all of these reserves and we haven't been using them. So now we have to make a decision. If we look at depletion, to Randy's point of view, around the world, all the easy oil, if you will, has been gotten. The places where there exists outside the United States are geopolitically difficult, geologically challenging, and we're still sitting on the reserves that we haven't tapped in the past 30 years. So we have to make a choice. Either we do that here, or, because we are still 94% dependent on oil for our transportation sector, and there is no magic bullet that we're just going to flip the switch overnight and be dependent on something else. It is going to take time. It is going to take a transition time, like Nancy said. So we either use some of the resources here, have that money invested here, or we become more dependent on imported oil from places that don't share our values and from places that don't have the type of environmental regulations that we have. So we make a choice. Is it here, invested here under an environmentally stringent regime, or do we import it, send the money overseas, the jobs overseas, and get it from places that don't have the environmental regulations? That's a fundamental choice we have to make. Secondly, on the chamber, yes, we have. The problem is, I wonder, has anybody read the chamber's energy and environmental proposal to the Obama administration and the Congress? Raise your hand if you have. Thank you. Two.
Okay, we've got two. Yeah.
There's 90 recommendations that we gave to this administration, this Congress, on how to grow the economy, improve our energy security, and improve the environment, starting with energy efficiency, heavy on things that we could be doing in R&D and science. It's an excellent plan. And we've been able to get about 25% of it done. We have endorsed, advocated for, and even lobbied for all of the alternative energy and renewable proposals that have come forward ever. So the idea that we're going to paint the chamber as a Neanderthal, that we're not for these things, is absolutely patently false. The reality is that we have to have a lot of energy sources on the table, and we can't be in the business of picking winners and losers. Are we going to transition to a clean energy future? Absolutely. Do we have to be realistic about the time frame and the cost? Yes. And I think that's what's missing about the discussion. And trying to paint people as either you're for energy or the environment is just a false choice. You have to be both. And I think it's really incumbent upon us to be more respectful of how we actually get there and realistic about what's needed to do that.
Karen, I assume you have a response to
Yes, I do. I'm also really concerned about the fact that we might be stuck with getting our oil from sources who don't have our values. Because that's what's happening right now, because we're getting it from Exxon and BP. And I believe that our oil infrastructure in this country, how we get it, is not reflective, actually, of the values of this nation. I think it's reflective of the values of a very powerful group of humans who profit from this at the expense of the environment at the expense of the planet itself as it continues to warm, and in many cases at the expense of local economies that become held hostage by very singular industries. My second point is, you know, two things I always worry about. When anyone tells me, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, or we can't change overnight, become very suspicious. Because those usually indicate that we're going to delay and delay and delay till it's too late. Nobody thinks we can change overnight. That's not the debate here. The debate is, are we taking the actions now that will lead to the change that we need to get to as quickly as possible? And I think the answer there simply is no. I think right now, if the administration wanted to lead us rapidly, sustainably, into a new energy environment, one that would prevent runaway global warming, I think that's our number one challenge here, it would start adopting policies that would remove the massive, massive subsidization of fossil fuels, which is one of the key things of preventing us from innovating on alternative fuels. And here's several things the administration could do. It could rescind the proposal to say, we're going to open up vast new areas to offshore oil drilling. And it could say, instead, today, we begin the ramp down of offshore oil drilling. That's the process that starts today. The first place you could start the ramp up of offshore oil drilling is Alaska. Okay. Most of our offshore oil drilling by far comes from the Gulf of Mexico. The country is very dependent upon that from day to day. So you need a long-term plan to change what we're doing in the Gulf. That is not true of offshore oil drilling in Alaska. It is not a major source of oil for the country. We should not be drilling for oil offshore in Alaska. The nearest Coast Guard station to the Shell project that the Obama administration just started to approve again 2 days ago is 1,200 miles away. If an oil spill happens in Alaska, there is not an army of fishing boats available to go out and hire and work to clean it up. If it happens in the wintertime, it could take approximately 3 weeks for an ice cutter to get to the station to even get at the blowout preventer. There is just no possibility of being able to clean up a spill of this magnitude in Alaska, but yet the administration is still going forward. Indeed, after we got a court order shutting down Shell's most recent proposal in the Chukchi Sea, the administration came back, supplemented the EIS in response to the court order, addressed the issue of catastrophic oil spill and said, yes, it can happen. No, we're not able to address it, and we're going to approve the project anyways. Basically, the policy is we're going to roll the dice. We should not be drilling up there. And by putting those things on the table, we start to move the economy, not overnight, but over the decades that are needed to ramp down offshore oil drilling, ramp down fossil fuels, get a level playing field for alternative fuels, and create the motivation for incentivization of alternative fuels.
I want to give Nancy a chance to respond to that, and then let's go back to Randy. Should we be drilling offshore in Alaska?
Well, I think I think it's just important to kind of clarify. The Shell project, I think, is the only lease sale that's gone forward, and it was done in 2000. It was definitely before 2009, and so in the March 30th announcement, he talked about putting Bristol Bay in the Cookland Inlet. Bristol Bay off limits, and then not going forward with any additional lease sales in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea, and I think exactly for the reasons that Karan talked about. I mean, it is a very difficult environment, and I think it's going to take a long time before we see any real expansion beyond the Shell leases. in Alaska. But I think there's no question that we need to invest more in energy efficiency. We need to invest more in renewable energy, and we need to reduce our dependence on oil that we have to import. We have to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. And we do have to move forward all of those things at the same time. But I think, there's a lot of, I mean, certainly we share a lot of concerns about development in the Arctic, I mean, not only because of the difficulty of responding to a spill, but because of some of the unique resources that are in the Arctic. But we're not the only Arctic nation, and there's a lot of development going on in other nations, other Arctic nations, and the U.S. is working through sort of its membership in the Arctic Council to try to work with other countries so we can have a more measured and considered way of developing resources in the Arctic across the Arctic.
Randy Udall, what does the Randy Udall plan look like if you were to have the ear of the president, or you could sit down with Tom Donahue of the Chamber of Commerce and give him your 2 cents?
My view is you have to reframe this discussion around prosperity and not the environment. I agree with the Chamber on that. I support deep water drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf has been a working landscape for 60 or 70 years. I was hoping we might have shrimp for lunch here tonight, but... the oil out of the Gulf. The oil out of the Gulf helped us win World War II. We have been so. I mean, imagine we need, as writers and journalists, we need to understand the energy basis of our civilization better than we typically do. I would strongly encourage you to read anything that Vaclav Smil, S-M-I-L, has written about energy. I don't think you can write intelligently about the environment or about the energy challenge without having a broad view that goes back at least 100 or 200 or 300 or 400 years. You have been born into a moment in human history. You've been born into a civilization, the greatest civilization we've ever seen on the planet. And it's the oil tribe. I call it the oil tribe. We, each one of us now in the U.S., we consume our body weight in petroleum every 7 days. The fact that we're not going to change that overnight is not a call, in my mind, for delay. It's a call for acceleration. It's a call for urgency, for rapidity, for getting going. We are raging through these fossil fuel resources, and not just in the U.S. Half of all the fossil fuel we've consumed on the planet has been burned in the last 25 years. Half of all the fossil fuel humans have burned in 10,000 years has been burned in the last 25. That's why we have a climate change problem. And we can talk about climate change all day long in the U.S. because it's a problem of abundance. And because it's abundance, it does not conflict with our national myth, the paradise spell under which we operate every single day of the week. Depletion is taboo, whether it's the Ogallala or it's petroleum in the deepwater Gulf of Mexico. A third of the world's oil is coming from the oceans. A half will be coming from the oceans by 2015. Trust me, BP would love to be drilling anywhere other than a mile or 2 miles of water. But that's where the oil is. The Sioux never had a conference where the bison came in and the Sioux said, you know, we've got this bison dependence. And it's very troubling to me. These huge mobs of them come up here every year and they piss in the river and they shit everywhere and they're bellowing. You know, we got to get off bison. The Sioux never had a conference like that. I actually think that what we're most missing in America is an appreciation, even a love, even an acknowledgement of what these fossil fuel resources have meant to us as a nation, as a people, and how important they are to our continued prosperity. At the same time, we understand we need to accelerate the move away from them, because future prosperity is very constrained now in a thermodynamic way, not by climate change necessarily, but by thermodynamics, by depletion. in a way that the chamber, very few people, I think Stephen Chu may understand this, but very few people in Congress do. And so that if we want to remain prosperous, there are things we need to do now with great urgency. And they mostly lie in the realm of radical resource efficiency.
I know Karen wanted to respond to that, and I think we're right about that time where we'd like to start taking your questions. So if folks who have questions, start coming up to the mics. SCJ members come first. Karen.
I just want to put an issue on the table because you said we wanted to get a food fight, so let's stir it up. We've been talking about fossil fuels. Let's talk about what you just said, Kieran, and what you just said. You said we need to be investing in the solutions. We need to be getting busy about it. You said we need to accelerate it, right? So the chamber took on a project, and we looked at all of the energy projects that have been proposed across the country for the last 3 years. And 380 of them have been stopped or canceled through the abuse of the environmental litigation process, the environmental permitting process, and bringing these projects into court. Fine. Well, that's an
Karen, we have 30 million acres.
But wait, no, let me finish.
We have 30 million acres in the West that have been leased to oil and gas companies.
No, this has nothing to do with oil and gas.
15 Yellowstones.
I want to
we have turned the industry loose in the Rocky Mountains.
No, this has nothing to do with that. These are not, that's not what I'm talking about. So listen for a second. 40% of those projects, those 380 projects, were renewable projects, wind turbines, solar projects, geothermal projects. These are projects that the environmental community itself has brought into court and litigated and stopped. This is the solution that is being stopped at every point, and it's coast to coast. You're welcome to go to our website. You can see the entire map, where these projects are, who the project sponsors are, who the litigants are, how much money has not been invested, how much jobs have not been invested, importantly, how much renewable energy has not been dispatched. So we're sort of, to use a Texas, I'm from Texas, you know, to use a Texas metaphor, you know, we're shooting ourselves in the foot and we're reloading and shooting again. Yeah. We say we want it, and then we take every single project into court. You look at Cape Wind or the solar facility in the Mojave Desert. You look at the long transmission line right outside of the Capitol in Washington. It took 18 years to get it permitted. What investor is going to wait 18 years? Look at Cape Wind. I mean, it's taken how long to get it done because we've litigated at every point. You look at things that are happening in the state of Washington, here in Montana, in California, across our country. It's not just coal plants. It's renewable energy that's being stopped through environmental litigation. And we have to address that head on. That's a reality. How is that happening? Is that really furthering our desire to transition to a low-carbon future, or it's standing in the way of it? It's standing in the way of it.
Well, let me save you some time, Avi. You don't have to go to the Chamber's website to find out who's litigating some of these alternative fuel projects. I am.
Told you we wanted to get it going.
And let me tell you why, and I'm going to, as I so often do, bring it back to the Obama administration. We, Center for Biological Diversity, and most other groups, are very interested in expanding alternative energy. And while we think that a good portion of that should be done on private land, we also think there are opportunities on public lands. We and other groups, knowing that, have gone out, spent a lot of time mapping out our public lands to find out where the most fragmented parcels are, where the most degraded parcels are, where there are no endangered species, where it's been previously degraded by past uses like livestock raising to the point where the chances of it being restored are not very minimal. And we've gone to the administration and said, target these areas. You need to lead industry. You need to be telling industry where it can go on public lands to avoid the kind of controversies that will cause people like me to shut you down.
So you're saying the administration should be directing that more proactively.
Absolutely, and it is not. We had this tremendous failure of the Department of Interior right now to actually show some leadership, go out, identify the good places on public land to do alternative energy development. Instead, the Department of Interior sits back, waits for an energy company to submit the permit to go on acre X, and then it knows it's going to have a food fight Because it's just picked an important biological site. Why does industry get to determine where we start to do alternative energy on public lands? That is the job of the administration, and again, the administration is not doing it. It's come up with these vast energy possibility areas on the order of millions of acres at a time. It provides essentially no guidance. So if you want to avoid environmental litigation, if you want to put alternative energy in the best place for it, you've got to have the government lead, and the government is not leading, and that's why we have these fights, and we'll continue to have these fights.
I want to give Nancy a chance to respond quickly, and then we're going to go to your questions. For folks who have questions, we'd like you to identify yourself. And remember, this is a question rather than an opportunity to give a long speech. Nancy.
Well, I think we don't. I don't think we have the comprehensive planning. I think that's right. But I also, I mean, these are public trust resources, and I think we have to be very careful about what we do on these public resources. So, I think comprehensive planning or not, the environmental laws that protect those public lands that are managed on behalf of the American people by whether it's the Department of Interior or any other agency. And so we have to make sure that that endangered species aren't affected. We have to go through the NEPA review. And, I think we're still trying to see what the best model is for the kind of that kind of comprehensive planning. I mean, in a way, look, the example of it, the example that exists is the offshore, the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act that does have a comprehensive planning for the offshore offshore areas I don't know if that's the best model for the kind of comprehensive planning that may be warranted with respect to renewable energy development on public lands.
All right, you have a question. Tell us your name.
My name's Eric Mack. I'm from New Mexico, and I just kind of wanted to ask the panel their thoughts on what they see for the possibilities of shifting some of our larger budget and policy priorities. And the illustration that comes to mind for me is I live in New Mexico, where the total state budget is about $10 billion, roughly. Actually, now it's $9 billion. But the Los Alamos National Labs have a budget of roughly $6 billion. And I know a lot of people where I'm from would love to see that devoted to addressing some of these problems, the incredible amount of resources and brains there. But it still seems to be devoted in the foreseeable future to manufacturing weapons that, as far as we know, are their biggest use may be to be stolen by terrorists. We don't know. But seriously, where do you see, what do you see in the possibilities for really changing our budget priorities away from such huge defense spending and on to real energy solutions?
Do you want to take a whack at that, Nancy, then Randy?
Well, look, I think the Department of Energy has under the leadership of our Nobel Prize-winning physicist who came from one of the labs, of really trying to focus their research, some of their basic research, on what are the energy technologies of tomorrow. It is true that the largest part of the Department of Energy's budget still has to do with managing the nuclear their nuclear portfolio, and it's a very important piece of both our national security here at home and globally. But I think the priorities, the president submits a budget to Congress, and Congress does what Congress does with the budget, and I think it's it is about who represents all of us in Congress, determining where those federal dollars are spent. I mean, there's no question that one of the most important functions that the federal government plays is to provide for the national security, and has always been and will continue to be. But in terms of the priorities within that, I think we see that the Department of Defense looking at energy as a real as they plan into the future, and they look out as far, I think, as any other federal agency, or probably further into what the world will look like in the next, whatever, 50 years, 100 years. And I know they see energy and climate change as a huge national security challenge, and I think they're looking at sort of their own operations and the way that they plan, really considering the impacts of constrained energy across the world.
Randy?
Yeah, this is painful for me. The Germans spend $10 billion, that's it, on their solar program each year. We're spending $10 billion, what, every 2 weeks in Afghanistan, Iraq. It's costing us $400 a gallon to deliver fuel to our soldiers in Afghanistan. How did we become so afraid as a people? I mean, we're spending more on our military than all other industrial nations combined. We're making the classic empire overreach. You talk to the Chinese, they'll tell you, you know, our leaders are engineers and scientists. And the Chinese, there's nothing inscrutable about what they're doing. They're going all over the world to purchase oil, coal, rare earth elements, the things that will help them secure their prosperity in the years ahead. And we're hemorrhaging money because there are 50 al-Qaeda still in Afghanistan or something. It just blows my mind. For $50 or $100 billion, we could shut down all these 30- and 40-year-old coal plants. We could incentivize or bribe these utilities that are going to run these things until they've totally cannibalized the climate. You could do a cash for clinkers program. I mean, if we simply redirected some of our spending, I think our chances of preserving prosperity and the goals that the chamber have are much higher, much more enhanced than the approach we're taking right now.
All right, over here, if you can tell us your name and also your organization, who you're employed by, or if you're freelance.
Yeah, I'm Eli Kintish with Science Magazine. I just like a show of hands in the room. Do you believe that human emissions of carbon dioxide, our industry causes climate change, global warming? Everyone in the room? So, Karen, I noticed you raised your hand. Why do you support candidates who question this belief, dozens of them?
Give me an example.
Republicans all around the country.
So now it's the Republicans believe this and Democrats believe it. That's the problem with the debate when you paint people with broad brush strokes.
No, that's not.
Now let's be clear.
No. We have looked at almost all the Republican candidates for the Senate. Nearly every one of them is questioning this essential scientific fact. And you raise your hand and support it. I'd like to know why you're supporting Republican candidates for Senate as well as Democrats. I don't know. But I looked at the list of Republicans, at least. Why do you support those who question this fundamental scientific belief?
Yeah, this is the question that disappoints me the most and which shows me why this debate is so paralyzed. When you look at the Waxman-Markey piece of legislation House of Representatives, it passed 219 to 212, okay? When you look at how that bill passed, it was 28 state delegations voted against that bill and 22 state delegations voted for that bill. A lot of the people that voted against that bill were moderate Democrats.
I'm not talking about policy. Okay? I'm talking about science.
But this is about policy.
No, it's about whether
policy
you believe science or not.
Policy is informed by science. We need better policy. We need better solutions.
Policy is informed by
everything. But by actually having a discussion where you seek to further polarize it, you will never get to the solution. Are people entitled to their opinions? Yes. They're not entitled to their own set of facts, which is why I made the point earlier about a set of facts that we can agree on.
Your
and
set
move
of facts,
things
you told
forward
people to read
in a
the policy. You told
manner.
People to read the chamber's policy. I just checked it out. It doesn't mention carbon dioxide as a cause of warming. How can you have a 75-page
What did you read? Tell
point?
Me what you read.
I read the policy you told us to do, the stimulate, you know, the planning.
21st century plan.
Right. I just took
Well,
a
if you don't have it, if you don't have copies of it, it's out there. It's 90-some-odd pages long. I encourage you to get a copy of it, read it, and see what it says.
I did. I just took a look, and it doesn't say carbon dioxide causes warming. How can you be a 21st century organization talking about energy and not state this fundamental fact?
I think you have to step back for a second and look at this. I don't
want
to take up all the time in this, is that we have to be a little bit more circumspect about how we have this debate. There are people that actually, in our southeastern part of our country, for example, that are hugely dependent on coal or nuclear and have no access to other
resources. That's not what I'm talking about.
Hold on. Yeah, sorry. Next question. Yeah. Do you want to add anything to this, any of the other panelists?
Karen, in all due respect, the chamber, and from the heart, the chamber's policy on climate change has just been abysmal. It's really not consistent with the settled, quote, science. And it's a sadness because you guys are bright, you're smart, and business has a huge role to play here. And it doesn't mean we're shutting all the coal down, we're not going to burn oil, we're not going to burn natural gas. We're going to work together, business, government, and environmental people are going to work together to ensure, preserve prosperity.
I think, but I think
North
we've been
America.
Very clear. We've said, you know what, there are scientists out there. We're not going to go down the science route. We've been very clear
about that. You
we've
have to go down.
Clear about that. What we have said is, let's move on and start investing in the solutions. Who's here for the solution? Or are we going to continue to talk about the problem? We're actually about the solution and what we need to do. Talk about the gentleman before that talked about funding. We've been calling for 3 years now to double the R&D investment in clean energy. We are currently investing less today, absent the stimulus package, less in clean energy R&D than we did after the Arab oil embargo. Are we putting our money where our mouth is? No. But does anybody want to talk about that? No. They want to continue to try and demonize people when we are trying to actually get to the type of technologies, get to the type of investment, get to the type of regulatory framework that will work. And that's what I think is the problem with this debate, is that we just want to say you're either for or against. It's actually we need to be all and. And that may make people uncomfortable, but it's a more realistic view of what needs to happen to be able to address our growing energy demand while addressing our environmental challenges.
Kieran, well, and then let's go to this question over here.
I, for one, would suggest that we actually go down the science route as we attempt to find solutions.
If you will look at pillar number 10 out there in our blueprint,
next
it actually
question.
Calls for
next
investing
question.
In the science so that we have better solutions.
Okay, question over here.
Howdy. I'm Tom Morton. I'm from the Casper Star Tribune in Casper, Wyoming. And God bless Ray Ring for giving me an edge into this because we are the BTU capital, I think, of the hemisphere. We're the leading uranium-producing state, and we got wind and a whole bunch of other things. How does a state like Wyoming, which is mostly traditional energy source place, fit in your respective visions of what economic policy should be?
Okay. And let's see. Randy, you want to start with that? Let's see if we can get to another question.
So Wyoming is fascinating. There are only three people talk about Wyoming as an energy state. It's not an energy state. There are only three countries in the world that produce more fossil fuel than Wyoming. Every day, 10,000 hopper cars of coal leave Wyoming carrying coal, carbon, and political influence all the way to the East Coast. And it's why you're never going to get a climate bill, not a strong one, through the U.S. Senator, why it's going to be very, very difficult. And so Karen's right. We need to invest more in R&D. These fossil, 90% of the remaining carbon buried underground in North America is in the Rocky Mountain West, if you go all the way from New Mexico up to Alberta. This region has an enormous role to play as we go ahead. And, you know, we're going to need these fossil fuels. To solve the climate problem, you've got to displace 10,000 hopper cars each day of coal coming out of Wyoming. That's going to take a long time. Smill's book, by the way, is called Energy Transitions. Read it. Moving to renewable energies from these concentrated fossil fuels is going to be very difficult. It's going to take a long time, and we need to get going on it as rapidly as we can. In the interim, we're going to need fossil fuel because if you don't preserve a social dialogue, I agree with you, Karen, if you don't preserve a social dialogue, the center is fraying now. I mean, this frightens me. The center is fraying. And if things go south here, if we make some wrong energy choices, you know, by 2030, people are going to be barbecuing baby boomers. You know, I mean, it could get really ugly. I mean, many baby boomers have always wanted to do something good for the future. Well, they might be doing something good.
Does anybody else on the panel want to respond to that before we go to the other question?
But I think just in that bumper sticker, I think that's the problem, is that there's not a one-size-fits-all solution. I mean, Wyoming's situation is very different than Montana's versus Rhode Island versus California. And so we have to be very careful about picking winners and losers in this because it's a national issue. And so I think it's a very good point that we have to keep. We can't change our energy reality. I mean, that's what everybody has to accept. We have what we have. Now we need to manage that going forward. We can't just wish our way to a new energy future. We've got to manage it. And that means we have to be very, very realistic about it, about situations in Wyoming, you know, versus other parts of the country.
Question.
Hi, I'm Matthew Daly with the Associated Press. This is for...
I like your last name, by the way, but yeah. Go ahead.
Different spelling. This is a question for Nancy Sutley, because I kind of want to circle back to a question that was asked earlier that I didn't really hear the answer. This is about whether, in fact, the Gulf oil spill was a missed opportunity. I mean, there is no climate bill. There's not even an oil response bill. And I think we sort of just breezed over the answer there. I think there's a lot of people in this country that are surprised at that, and maybe some are happy because it didn't happen, but I think it would be good to just hear your answer why you think there is no climate bill, A, and B, why there's no even oil response bill.
Well, you know, I think we're still, I think, dealing with the aftermath of the oil spill. I think, you know, Congress, the House took up the Clear Act. It hasn't, the Senate hasn't acted yet. The Senate hasn't acted on a climate bill, and you know, certainly for this Congress, there's not a whole lot of time left on their particular
block. My question is that, you know, there's a Democratic president, Democratic Congress. This is something that President Obama has said repeatedly he wants to happen. Do you think that there's been a failure of presidential leadership on this?
Well, I think that I think it's actually much simpler than that, which is we just haven't had the votes in Congress. And, you know, in the midst of, you know, the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, there's a lot of things that we've had to do in response to that, and including pushing this energy policy forward. And, you know, we did have the House of Representatives pass a climate bill. We've done a lot of things administratively, and the piece that's missing is we haven't had a final vote in Congress on the bill. We think that's very important. We need to continue to work to try to get an energy bill out of the Congress. So, you know, it's going to continue to be a priority. The president has talked about that, and we'll continue to work on it.
John?
Yeah, I'd like to address that. I don't think it's possible for the Senate to pass a climate bill without a massive expenditure of political capital by the President of the United States. And he chose not to do it. He chose to put that in Congress's hands and say, Congress, that's your job. If FDR waited for Congress to act on its own to deal with the Depression, we'd still be in the Depression. The President needs to lead. The President needs to pressure Congress. The President needs to twist arms. I think one of the lowest moments in the climate debate was when Obama went to Copenhagen and basically refused to articulate a presidential policy and instead said, this is what the House has passed. This is what we can do. Basically said, I am not the leader of this nation. I am not going to articulate where we should be. I am not going to push Congress where it needs to go. I'm simply going to repeat what Congress has already done. In conditions like that, we cannot and will not pass a climate bill in the Senate. And so the Senate has its own problems, believe me. I'm not letting Harry Reid off the hook here at all. But I do believe that when we're dealing with probably the most important global problem in the history of the human race, for the President of the United States of America to refuse to expend massive political capital to solve it is extremely disappointing.
We're getting close to the end of our time, which is disappointing because I think we can keep going. A lot of very interesting ideas that are coming out here. So I think we might have time for two more questions, but they've got to be quick questions, quick answers. Over here.
I'm Carrie Hansen with Indian Country Today. My question is directed.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Karen Harbert, Carrie Hansen, Indian Country Today. So you mentioned lawsuits stopping projects, which raised a question for me. I know that some of those lawsuits were raised by the tribes. How are they being notified of these projects ahead of time? How are you involving the tribes? A lot of the coal and natural resources lies under tribal lands and impacts tribal communities. And I heard Randy mention working with business, government, and environmental groups. I have not heard the word tribes. I was wondering.
The tribes, I mean, it was interesting for me to listen to the Native woman yesterday saying, we would never think of hunting wolves. Wolves are totem animals for us. We would not issue permits to go hunt wolves. The tribes are sitting on an ocean of renewable energy flowing over the northern Great Plains every single day. The best wind sites in the world are in South Dakota and North Dakota. But politically, this is rural co-op country. This is the 75% of America, geographic areas served by the rural co-ops, who started out being the most progressive utilities in America and now have become the most regressive. And it's sad, Karen, it's really sad to me, because this is where the chamber needs to lead. And as long as you guys have your head in the sand on the science, which they don't do in China, there's no dispute about the science in Europe, South America, anywhere in the world except in the U.S. And the chamber could help enormously in bringing those rural utilities on. I mean, this is the part of the world that's being depopulated. Economic activity is dying out there. And they're just staring at an enormous new resource.
Yeah.
All right, Karen, very quickly, and then
very quickly,
lightning round.
Just to be clear, the chamber doesn't have any role in these pieces of litigation. We are merely reporting on the number of them across the country. And if we have missed some, please let us know. We want to make sure that we have a complete inventory of all of these. They're not all yours, but there are others, certainly. So. We might have missed some of yours, too, but just to give a complete view of what is happening. So we'll certainly take a look to make sure that we have been inclusive of all the different pieces of litigation. And Randy, let me say, it is wonderfully warming to me to hear that you think the chamber can fix this problem. And we intend to be leading on this, on the energy issue, certainly over the next remaining 2 years. So we'll take you up on that challenge.
Very quickly, I mean, DOI has a very special relationship to the tribes in regard to these energy issues. And two ways in which I think they're playing out very negatively is Interior going forward with proposals, particularly on the mining side, whether it's for coal or very often uranium, without consulting the tribes, over the objection of the tribes. Much of this is on lands that are not officially within the borders of the reservations, but are their historic lands. And then secondly, there's a real subsidization problem. One of the issues in the Mojave with solar, for example, is it's cheaper for solar developers to go onto federal land and put their facilities there where they're going to be subsidized than put them on tribal lands where the tribes want them and pay the tribes a market value. And so we actually have the Department of Interior undermining the economy of the tribes by creating an unfair economic system when we've got folks who want to house these solar projects and have a good place to put them. Last question.
Yes, I'm Francesca Lyman. I'm a freelance writer. I've written a lot about energy and a book on global warming. And I wanted to direct this question to Nancy Sutley directed to her point about using the U.S. government's procurement policies to change federal buildings and do everything it can to put its money where its mouth is. And in this regard, you had talked about reducing greenhouse gases across the board by 28% for all federal government buildings and so forth. And I had it on the QT from somebody at the Pew Center that, unfortunately, the federal government hadn't gotten very far in terms of green building its buildings. And this is not to put you on the spot, but really to say, you know, is it true? I mean, have you, in fact, started this process? Is there a plan for doing this? Could this be a model for our government that you could then use to portray, you know, American ideals and the sustainability ideas of the Obama administration? So I wanted to know, how far is that plan along, and does it rival in any way the things being done by Japan, Germany, and other countries that are using its federal purse to change things?
Well, the target, first of all, the executive order was issued just about a year ago, requiring us to set these new targets, and the greenhouse gas emission, the overall greenhouse gas emission target was set in January. So the agencies have submitted their or completed their sustainability plans, and they were just released publicly in August. So things are on their way. I mean, the federal government for a long time, and not just in this administration, in the prior administrations before, have been pushing for federal agencies to operate more sustainably, to use less energy, to invest more in energy efficiency and renewable energy, to reduce the fleet-wide fuel use. And I think the federal government, you know, in the early 90s was one of the early leaders in green buildings, and some of it has to do with, you know, when we build buildings and how we build buildings. But you see great examples across the country of really innovative ways that federal agencies are constructing buildings. The National Renewable Energy Lab, it has their net zero building, and other, in across the country in installations, DOD installations and others, we see lots of great examples of green buildings. We're fortunate to have in the Recovery Act money that provided directly for retrofitting existing federal buildings to make them greener, also focus on with the Veterans Administration and doing retrofits renovations at both existing VA hospitals, as well as incorporating green building practices into their new hospital. So I think the federal government, has a lot to show in this. There's a lot more coming. And I think we see this across the board. We see it in state and local government. We see it in the private sector. 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 We see